See, there's an interesting thing that the Bible talks about, because it talks continually about the lest ye see miracles, ye will not believe. Remember the disciple that had to stick his finger literally into the wound in Christ's side before he would accept the fact that Christ was resurrected, before he'd believe. And the fact of the matter is that people who only believe because of miracles, their belief is not enough, because they're overriding a resistance in them to belief. And even Paul, who was certainly a very, very high being, went in and out of being that highest being. He wasn't finished yet. He wasn't a fully realized being. He wasn't Jesus. Some of the things Paul said in some of his letters were very hang-uppy, institutional-type statements. And some of them were statements of pure light. He was very erratic. Because the way Paul got his belief was because he was right in the middle of his horseback ride. He was struck, you know. I mean, he was told in no uncertain terms how it was. See, and many people say to me, I don't understand what you're doing. And I say, there's nothing I can say to you, really. But I can give you a method whereby you can yourself experience something which will allow you to understand what it is I am doing. That's all I can do for you. It's like try to explain to somebody what it is like to eat a raw oyster. Well, it's certainly the easiest thing to do is get a raw oyster and tell them to open their mouth and stick it in. Or explain to somebody how strawberry ice cream is different from chocolate ice cream. See, science can only indirectly be concerned with these issues because it can't deal with direct experience. It can only deal with reports of experience. If I taste strawberry ice creamness, my experience of tasting strawberry ice creamness can never be science because it's a personal experience, and scientific data must be public knowledge. Therefore, I can fill out a questionnaire and say the strawberry ice cream tasted cold, warm, cold. It tasted sweet, sour, sweet. And then we'll get 100 of people and they'll all say it was cold and sweet, and then we'll say, that's science now. Science says, aha, they report coldness and sweetness. Does all those labels on that questionnaire have anything to do with the experience of strawberry ice creamness? Well, believe me, they don't add up to the same thing, and you all know that. In the same way that all of the words any visionary has ever said about his vision don't have anything whatsoever to do with the vision. They're sort of like, well, it's not to say they don't have anything to do, but they're trivial. They're trivial words. And whole religions have been built on that trivia. That's the problem. Whole religious systems have been built on that kind of trivia. We are talking specifically about the concept of faith, it turns out today, though I certainly hadn't planned to. See, you may have just enough faith to see Buddha when you're alone, but when somebody else is around who doesn't see Buddha, you can't see Buddha. Just can't see Buddha when somebody else is around who's not seeing Buddha. And that's why Ramakrishna says, that when you start your spiritual work, you are like a very tender tree that must be surrounded by a fence, because otherwise all the animals will come along and they'll step on it. And later on, when the tree gets very big and strong, everybody can lean on it and get shade from it. Or it's like trying to cross the ocean of existence with a leaf or on a bamboo shoot. If your bark is very delicate, you really can't take many people across on it, or everybody goes under. If you just cool it for a while and wait, it may get so that everybody can go across on it. So at the same moment, when you have seen the light, for example, you have a desire to share the light with the people you love. I mean, that's a very powerful, gregarious force in nature. And the fact is that you can't do it at a certain point, because you don't have enough light yet. You don't have enough awareness. You don't have enough faith in the reality that you're seeing, which is slightly different from the reality that you were in before, to be able to share it with somebody who has the old reality. Because the strength of their commitment to what they know and your lack of strength in your new commitment is just enough so that you'll keep going under all the time. See, that's why my 5 months when I couldn't read the New York Times and I couldn't read Time Magazine and I was sitting in a temple with all kinds of other Mashugana people, all of whom were seeing Buddha there. The result was that I could build an acceptance of this other awareness to the point that when I came back into an environment out of which my traditions had, in which others were trained in my traditions, and they said, he isn't there, I could feel compassion and say, gee, I feel terribly sorry that you can't see him there. And I love you very much. It was interesting, when I was thrown out of Harvard, one of the comments that was made the year after in a press interview, one of the reporters said to me, you know, you're amazingly undefensive for somebody who's been through what you've been through and been maligned and told you're wrong and all. Now, it was a very delicate matter, because if I said what I thought, I'd say, well, that's okay because I'm right. But you know how they would interpret that. Couldn't say that. So I said, yeah, well, that's interesting. See, a young person has an experience which puts him in a slightly different perceptual vantage point than his parents. And his parents say, you are wrong, and they can get the kid to say, I am wrong, but there is something in the kid that knows that he isn't wrong. And they don't have to beat him to say, because he is so interrelated to their value system that he is willing to buy back and say, I must have been wrong. But yet that experience was a direct experience, and he can't reject it. And he's caught in this terrible bind where he's now in a dishonest condition with himself. And in order to stay in harmony with his parents, he must reject his own direct experiences. But it takes a great deal of faith to be so rooted in a new system that you can meet somebody in the system you just came out of, honor them, respect them, allow them to stay in their system, not feel the necessity to convert them, honor them, and find that place which is behind their system and your system where we are. It takes a kind of commitment and faith that stands up in spite of. It's like the mumbling in the church, but it's still round. It still goes round. When he is forced to recant, but it still goes round. Couldn't reject. Couldn't reject his direct understanding of how it was. See, it's like going to school and you come home, and I used to come home and my mother would say to me, "How did the teacher say you're doing at school?" That's a different question from "What are you learning?" which is a different question about "Do you feel you're learning anything?" I grew up in a culture where you knew yourself on the basis of how others thought about you. First your parents, then your teachers, then your colleagues, then your administrators. And so when the first inner voice comes that says, like, this is the way it is, if it's at odds with all those others, the rest of that, those attitudes around you, the tendency is to get pretty uptight, because in general you've rejected that, but it comes through with a certain kind of validity. The thing is that the history of people who have had direct mystical experiences or direct spiritual experiences is, no matter how hard they try, they can't refute them. They can't refute them. And so what then starts to happen is that the person has got to develop a set of attitudes to allow him to maintain that inner belief system, that new belief. See, I'm a Western scientist, and then suddenly I have an experience in which suddenly I believe in God, but Western scientists don't believe in God. Now we got an interesting question. What do I do? At first, I try very hard to hold on to being a Western scientist because that's my bread and butter. That's my gig in society. That's what gets me all of the brownie badges. And it gets harder and harder and harder, and the strain gets more and more intense. And finally, it just gets unbearable. I got to go one way or the other. But I don't have any choice. What choice do I have? Am I going to say, well, then I guess I'm a scientist and all that was wrong? How do you do that? How would you even know where to step next if you reject your own experience, your own direct experience? I mean, that's like you get into the car and you drive down the street and you meet another car coming over the hill and you stop and somebody says to you, "There's no car there. Drive on." How would you do it? How would you know whether the next car you met was a real car or not? The minute you reject your own experience, all you can say at that point is, "Look, I see a car. I guess I better not drive because I'm seeing cars. I'm seeing pink elephants." Finally, what is required? Finally, what is required is that you take the injunction given so beautifully in Shakespeare, to thine own self be true, then canst thou be false to no man. You've got to find a way to live it out, being totally in harmony with your inner experiences. Because you're building your house upon sand the minute you reject your inner experiences because they're too dangerous and too scary. You become what Dave Reisman calls other-directed. And it's not enough. But you see, the way you learned the original model of the universe was with a certain amount of emotional tone such that you felt that if you lived outside of it, the whole thing would crumble and it would all be horrible. That was the way in which it was taught. That was the leverage that was used, whether it's called eternal damnation or it's called you're going to suffer poverty. It's do like your mother says, otherwise it'll be ugly. All the way along, do like your mother says, otherwise it'll be ugly. Do like your father says, he knows best. So there is a lot of anxiety to the experience of having an inner experience that is disparate from the existing cultural perception of the universe. It's really pretty scary. It's really pretty scary, and many of us have wished many times that it hadn't happened. Why can't I be like everybody else? Why did it have to happen to me? But the game is such that it's irreversible and irrevocable. And you should have thought of that before. And once the seed is planted, it's too late. And the fact is, you had no choice, really. The seed was planted because you were ready to have the seed planted. But it's going to take you a long time to go from the place where you felt horror that you are now in a disparate position to the culture to feeling compassion for the culture because it's stuck in a place where you are not. That's a far out one. You really got to be crazy for that one. To say everybody is wrong and I am right. And believe it? To say it bluffly, that's one thing, you know. You're all wrong and I'm right. Yeah. It's different. But to just know that that's the way it is, quietly and calmly, and live with that. Live with that. What can you do? What is there to do? What is there to do about it? Let's say you find yourself in this predicament. What is there to do about it? can't convince anybody because it can't be said through words. It can only happen through experience because everybody else is in the same predicament you are. They all have that strong attachment too. Well, at first everybody gets very grandiose with their plans of how to do it. Why don't we put LSD in the water supply? They say. Of course, that's not going to work. That's just going to scare everybody. I won't plant the seed. Just plant fear and terror. That's like turning over the tables of the temple. Can't do that. You can't do it. Nothing you can do. You're in this absurd predicament. It's just like the Philadelphia Inquirer ad in the New Yorker. There's nothing you can do about it. The train is bearing down, and everybody's reading the paper, and they're so fascinated with the paper, and you're screaming, look out for the train, and nobody's listening to you, and there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do. So what do? You work on yourself. You center more and more. You get calmer. You build on that little light inside. You keep building your system. And after you get over the horror and the awe of being in this disparate position to everyone else, you find out that there are ways of getting across that interface. There are ways of making contact such that the difference isn't as important as you thought it was. And that you and I, even though I see Buddha and you don't, we can still be buddies. We just don't have to talk about Buddha. We don't have to talk about Buddha. Because then you find out that all of your symbols just get in the way. And that there is a way of making contact behind the way you see reality and behind the way I see reality. And we can find a place where we can both be together, where it's all right. But in order for that to happen, I have got to be able to give up my attachment to my new symbol. And I'm asking the same thing of myself as I was asking of somebody else. In other words, finally, I can only say to another human being, here we are right now, here and now in the present. And there's no your model and there's no my model and there's no need to understand how it all is and how to agree or disagree or agree to disagree or anything. Forget all that. Here we are. What should we do? What is there? What is it? What is needed? What is this at this moment? Well, we're hungry. Who's going to cook? Now, if I say, well, God will take care of everything, I've just lost him. What I'm saying is that there are many people in a social system at any time that are living in different stratas of reality, different degrees of consciousness. And it is possible to jump these interfaces between these levels of consciousness, and it is always the responsibility of the most conscious being to do it. See, what did he say? Paul Twitchell? The higher one climbs on the spiritual ladder, the more he will grant others their own freedom and give less interference to another's state of consciousness. The more I'm conscious, the less I got to come on to you about how I believe. It all is. Because with higher consciousness comes compassion. And compassion is the understanding of why everybody is at the place they're at. Did you ever be around somebody who has a little boy with them, and the little boy can't do exactly what an adult do, and the adult keeps saying to them, come on, step aside, you can't do it. That constant, you're just a little boy, you can't do it. But not even you're a little boy, like you're some incompetent being because you're not big. Compassion is a true empathy, a true understanding of why each person is in the predicament they're in and exactly where they're at that moment. It's more than empathy. It's a total identity with the other person. You see, we are. This is who we are. I am Richard Nixon in the White House. I am caught in my dilemma of my history as a Quaker and my background and my values and my attitudes and my attachments and my responsibilities and my problems. And I am as much Richard Nixon as I am Ram Dass.